Chapter 53. Ruth. The crowds began to gather along the parade route in Manhattan at 5 a.m. By 6:30, the streets were packed with families, five deep, waiting for the parade to begin at 9. Ruth didn't want to stand in the cold for that long. She had booked a window table at Stella 34 Trattoria. She arrived at 8:30 and entered Macy's on 35th Street. The express elevators took her straight to the restaurant, where she was seated with coffee and pastries as the parade began. The restaurant was full of kids, some in fancy dress, some of the parents too. There was face painting and a holiday atmosphere that gave Ruth a warm feeling. Her early memories of Thanksgiving were getting up early to watch the parade on TV. Her family rarely went into the city on parade day. Her mom didn't like the crowds, and her father complained about parking. After her parents divorced, Ruth didn't get to go to the parade until she was an adult. When she'd first moved to Manhattan, Ruth made a point of coming to Stella 34 to watch the parade. It was expensive, $400 for a table, which she couldn't afford back then. But being so close to the sights and sounds, and the floats and bands and cheerleaders, it was magical, and worth living off instant noodles for a month afterwards. The wonder on the faces of the children around her was more soothing than she cared to admit. Knowing she would never bring her own child to the parade somehow didn't matter in that moment. It would afterwards, but not now. She gazed at the excitement in the children's eyes as they pointed at the vast inflatables of their favorite cartoon characters. But more than anything, Ruth just loved the spectacle of it all. The highlight for the kids, and for the grown-ups too, was the big guy, Macy's Santa, closing the parade. It reminded her of sitting on her father's lap, watching Miracle on 34th Street. Nostalgia was good for the soul. As the parade wound down, Ruth made for the gift shop and saw snow globes on sale. One caught her eye. A miniature family, all in their winter clothes, standing on a snow-covered hill. A mother, father, and two kids. She shook it, watched the white plastic particles dance in the liquid, and then slowly descend on the hill. It was a plain souvenir with no music box in the base, but still, she couldn't resist. Ruth took the globe to the counter and paid for it. The assistant put it in a flimsy box for her, and then Ruth went to the elevator. She was first in line. Stepping inside as the doors opened, she moved to the rear of the elevator car, turned, and leaned against the mirror on the back panel. Two children came inside. One was dressed as a bumblebee, a little boy, probably 4 or 5 years old, with long blonde baby curls. His sister was a little older. She was a fairy princess in a pink sparkly dress with fine plastic wings on her back covered in glitter. The fairy princess held her mom's hand, a woman with dark brown hair, chestnut. She wore an expensive navy cashmere coat and an equally expensive scent. The father was tall, with close-cut black hair, a square jaw, and the most luminous, almost shimmering blue eyes. The family exuded the old wealth and privilege that was the dream of everyone who came to the city. The boy stood close to his father, who smiled at Ruth as he got in, then turned his back on her to face the door. Her heartbeat quickened. The big scar on her belly began to itch and burn, as if someone was swiping a blowtorch over it. Macy's department store was in an old building, a New York staple. With age came character, and an accelerating demand on maintenance. The doors rattled and screeched closed, and the elevator descended with a metallic whine. The noise made her wince as it resounded in her head painfully. For a moment, Ruth didn't know if it was the elevator making the noise, for in her mind, the old chest was vibrating, the wood was groaning, and the entire chest shook, rumbling on the floor. Something inside was trying to get out. The thick chains around it screamed with the strain as the lid threatened to break every link. Instinctively, Ruth covered her ears. It took half a second to register that she'd let go of the snow globe. She realized right before she heard it exploding on the floor of the elevator. It sounded like a shot. Ruth heard something else mingled with that noise, metal being torn asunder, wood splintering, and the whine of heavy brass hinges turning. The two kids jumped, and the girl let out a short squeal of surprise and hugged her mom, burying her face in the mother's coat. The globe had burst out of the box. Fragments of wet, curved glass sat in the puddle of liquid that had gushed from the globe. Ruth bent down to pick up the box. As she did so, she must have stepped on a shard, because she heard a sound. That sound. The same sound she'd heard in the bedroom of her brownstone in Manhattan that night, all those years ago. The crunch of glass underfoot. She saw her reflection in the broken arch of glass, her image distorted from the curvature, but still brightly lit from the overhead light in the elevator. That sound again, crunch. Her flesh burned with fear. Her fingers began shaking as they reached down. Crunch. And then she froze. Her throat closed. Her body shut down as if someone had thrown a circuit breaker in her brain. She couldn't move, couldn't breathe. All she could do was see. Her eyes locked on the floor, because there was another face reflected in that elliptical shard of glass. A man with dark hair and iridescent blue eyes, gazing down upon her. Ruth's head swam, and she was no longer in Macy's elevator. She was at home, in New York, in her hallway. Scott was out partying, and she was looking at her attacker's reflection in the broken pane clinging to the frame of her back door. Her head tilted up. She didn't want to look, but she couldn't stop herself. As her gaze lifted, she saw them, all of them, staring at her in unison, the little boy, the girl, the mother, and him. Cold grins on their faces. Their eyes were set in anger, twin orbs of blue flame in each of their faces, all of them looking right at her. And then she heard them. They spoke as one, a stentorian choir of sibilant voices. "Hello, sweetheart," they said. The elevator stopped suddenly with a booming thunk, taking Ruth to the floor. When she looked up, the father, the mother, and the boy had turned away, staring at the doors, waiting patiently for them to open. The mother had a tight grip on her daughter's hand. She whispered to her to turn round, that she shouldn't stare. But the little girl did not turn away. The fairy princess stared at Ruth over her shoulder, with large, blue, innocent eyes. Those eyes were so big and so gentle. Her wings glistened in the light. Her child's lips parted into a smile.
"Happy Thanksgiving," said the fairy princess sweetly.
Ruth, on her knees, was close enough to smell hot chocolate on the little girl's breath. Another screech came as the doors parted. Ruth held her palm to the side of her head. She could feel a terrible pain pulsating in her skull. She stepped out of the lift, following the family as they weaved through the first floor back onto 35th Street. The headache began to ease, and she tapped at her wrist as she walked, keeping the family in sight and trying to keep the panic down. She kept her distance along 35th Street, two blocks, watching the wings of the fairy princess fluttering in the wind that whipped round the corners. Then a right on 5th Avenue, and they doubled back up 34th Street, avoiding the crowds and the blockades as they were dismantled after the parade. They went into George Towers. The concierge held the glass entrance doors open for them. They walked past the reception desk and straight to the elevators. Ruth stood in the recessed entrance, took her pack of cigarettes from her bag, and pretended to fumble with the pack and her lighter. The concierge ignored her. He waited by the elevators, which were old and now considered positively chic in the city. A black iron gate had to be drawn away when the elevator arrived, and then closed again by the concierge before the elevator ascended, like something from an old Hitchcock movie, thought Ruth. The family got into the elevator. The concierge closed the gate and wished them a good day. Ruth opened the glass door and went inside. The concierge asked if he could help her.
"My lighter just went out. Do you happen to have a light or a book of matches?"
"Sorry, ma'am," he said.
"Thanks, anyway," she said, turning towards the doors.
She took out her phone, stalling for time. She held it to her ear, said,
"Hello?"
She knew the concierge was watching her. She took another step towards the exit, slow. There was a floor display above the elevator, Art Deco design, with a clock hand like an arrow that swiped from left to right, from floors 1 through 10. She watched the arrow on its arc, saw it stop at floor 10, the top floor. Then she took another step.
Ma'am, this is private property, residents only, said the concierge.
Uh-huh, she said into the phone, holding up an apologetic hand. She walked to the exit, turned again, one last time to mouth, thank you, at the concierge, and checked the readout above the elevator. It was still on 10. That was their floor. The elevator hadn't moved for over a minute. No question that was their destination. She glanced to the right, at the gold inlaid mailboxes. They were in numerical order, 1001, 1002, 1003. Three apartments on the 10th floor, a brass nameplate beside each one. 1001, R. Walker. 1002, R. Roman. 1003, The Grangers. Ruth left the building, put her phone back in her pocket, and headed through the crowds back to her car in the lot on 29th Street. The Grangers. It wouldn't take long for her to find out more about them online. Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter. She could have all the pictures she needed to create her fake web pages of news stories in a few hours. This one would be more complicated than any before. She would need someone special for this. In the elevator at Macy's, they had looked at her. They'd recognized her. And they'd spoken all those words together. They all knew. The one who'd attacked her, the father, he must have told them. They were laughing at her. She clutched her scarred stomach. The man who did this to her needed to be punished. He should suffer. He should watch his children die. Then his wife should be killed in front of him, right before he was murdered. Luckily, she had the perfect partner for the Grangers, someone she had been working on for the last 2 months. His name was Gary Childers. When she got back to her car, she fished in her bag and found the burner phone with the label Gary on the back. She turned it on, cycled through the messages. Gary had been talking to her for 2 months now. Actually, he was talking to a woman he thought was called Amy, one of her current aliases. Gary had lost his entire family, wife and teenage daughter, when their house burned down in Jersey. A local boy from a troubled family, 17 and full of spit and venom, well known to the police, had been out the night before, shooting fireworks around the neighborhood. Gary had caught him and told him to stop being an asshole or he would call the cops. The next night, Gary was on night duty. He was a security guard watching a warehouse in a nearby industrial park. He told Amy he saw a fire in the distance one night. He could see the flames burning over the rooftops of the houses a mile and a half away, lighting up the sky. When he got the call from the NYPD halfway through his shift, he collapsed. According to the local kid's parents, he had been at home that night, all night. The fire department said the fire had been caused deliberately. The front door had been nailed shut, his back porch soaked in gasoline. The fire had been ignited with a type of firework that spat out sparks like crazy. Ruth scrolled through Gary's messages, then found what she was looking for.
I can't move on. It's not right. There's no justice. I want to kill that fucking kid. Before I blow his brains out, I want to kill his father and his mother and his kid brother, and I want him to watch. Then I'll do him.
And below that message, Amy's reply. I know exactly how you feel. Of all the men and women who had killed for Ruth, Gary was perhaps the most dangerous, the most seriously unhinged. Avenging heroes don't kill children. She needed someone special, like Gary. To kill a fairy princess, a bumblebee, and mom and pop too, she needed a monster. Gary was that monster. She turned on the car, lighting up the dash. The purr of the engine soothed her. She tapped her thigh, tried to control her breathing. She connected her phone to the car's Bluetooth and called him.
Amy,
he said. His voice was thick and slow.
The one and only, said Ruth. I wanted to call and see how you're doing.
He sighed, said,
I'm not good, to be honest. It's always tougher around the holidays.
She could tell from his voice he'd been drinking.
You don't have your gun with you, do you? She asked.
Right here, beside me on the kitchen table.
Is it loaded?
Not yet.
Do me a favor, Gary. Don't load it. Not today. Not yet. I know it's hard. It's so terribly fucking hard. But you're giving up on your family if you put that gun in your mouth. Don't quit on me. I need you. I've been thinking about Kirk and my little Sammy. It would have been our fifth Thanksgiving as a family if that drunk driver hadn't ended it all.
I've been thinking about my family, too. It's not fair, Amy. It shouldn't be this way.
I know exactly how you feel.
You always have,
he said. Gary, what I'm going to say may sound a little crazy.
Don't worry. I'm all in favor of crazy these days.
She pretended to laugh, then said, well, I've been doing some thinking. Tell me, have you ever seen the movie Strangers on a Train?